Welcome to recent advances in cancer care, new paradigms, novel agents, and what it means for the oncology nurse this year at the 51st Annual ONS Congress. Thank you for being here this evening. We're going to talk about management of ovarian cancer. We have an amazing faculty here today. I'm Dr. David O'Malley from Columbus, Ohio. I'm joined by Brad Monk from the Florida Cancer Specialists and Research Institute, Ms. Katie Schlenecker. She just got married this year, so I'm working on it. Katie from Alabama, and Jacqueline Shaver from Stevenson Cancer in Oklahoma. So we have a very, very entertaining and an educational discussion here today. It is unbelievable amount of information in a 90-minute program. Commercial support is being provided by AbbVie, AstraZeneca, Corcept, as well as Merck, with regards to this educational. Thank you for their support. Our research to practice does not have any relationships with those companies. We are going to be talking about non-FDA approved agents. So many of the things we talk about today are not yet being utilized and approved by the FDA, but being utilized in clinical trials. So please refer to your prescribing information. And I think as we look at this, really important for us, as we talk about this as clinicians, it's important for us to keep in mind why we're utilizing certain therapies, Kaplan-Meier curves, the differences between the benefit we see in these agents, but also waterfall plots, the impact that we have in those that respond and the criteria, and Brad's going to talk a little bit about that. This is our agenda. As I said, we have a lot to get through. Each session's about 7 minutes, and we're going to keep going right through this together. And I'm really, really happy to be joined here with you all today. Thank you. So let's start off with some questions. You know, I think we were talking about this before. Who should be screened for ovarian cancer for genetics and even somatic testing?
It's a really easy answer. Every ovarian cancer should be screened for genetics. Not only is it going to affect their family, but it's also now involved in our treatment for these patients. Before, it wasn't, but now, thank goodness, that we have some new strategies that we can really impact patient outcomes and care. And so by knowing their genetics, we can know which treatment options that we have available to those patients. So it's a really easy answer, every ovarian cancer patient.
And our nursing colleagues have a great opportunity to make sure that every patient has ovarian cancer, has both germline and somatic. Katie, you have a really, really cool position. At Alabama, you actually run the embedded clinic in GY oncology for genetics, correct?
Yes, that's correct. I work alongside a couple of genetic counselors. We do one clinic a week. And we meet with patients and their spouses, their families, their children to talk about doing germline testing, which germline testing is hereditary testing that's checking to see if they were born with an inherited mutation at birth that predisposed them to develop certain cancers or put them at a higher risk compared to the general population. And so part of our counseling in that clinic is talking about how the individual who has the diagnosis of cancer is the best person to start testing with, but their results can have implications on their relatives, specifically first-degree relatives. That would be sort of the next testing strategy. So part of my counseling is for the patient, but part of my counseling is also just to explain that if we identify a germline mutation in them, we could potentially help prevent cancers or detect cancer early in their family members and future generations. And that's, by and large, the number one motivator for why a lot of my patients come in to do hereditary genetic testing.
So the amazing thing is in ovarian cancer, our incidence is going down. The number of cases which are diagnosed annually in the United States is going down. Why is that? Cascade testing.
Correct.
Right? Removing those tubes and ovaries, removing the uterus of his Lynch syndrome, tubes and ovaries of his BRCA. But we're also taking out more tubes, which is important. Mm-hmm. But yet patients are living so much longer. There's so many more people alive with ovarian cancer. So the prevalence is going up, though the incidence is going down. Brad, we have in your slides, we've talked about three or four different really important decisions. One of the things that a lot of times what we're looking at is, you know, who are you going to do neoadjuvant chemotherapy? Who are you going to add Bev? Who are you going to add PARP inhibitors to? So why don't you start that off, and I'd love to then go right into your presentation about PARP inhibitors.
Yeah, thank you. I couldn't emphasize enough, and thank you for what you're doing, and thank you for what you're doing. There's not a day that goes by that I don't talk to a nurse. Aren't I a lucky guy, right? And so thank you, Dr. O'Malley, for having me. So, yes, every patient should have the germline testing, which is every cell of her body, could be blood test, and every tumor tissue should be tested. So that allows us to figure out what the best treatment is. And so we'll get into that. Every patient needs chemotherapy, almost. Some of these early stage cancers do not. And every patient needs chemotherapy. And God bless, we're not, the O'Malley, and we're not giving the chemotherapy. So you are on the field, if you will, and helping us treat our patients. So we appreciate that. I want to talk now about these newly diagnosed advanced cases. Most patients are full of cancer when we find them. And I wish we had a screening test. We don't. And it's not a CA-125, and it's not an ultrasound. So I'm going to try to keep this sort of pretty simple, because I'm a simple guy. So I've had several career goals. One is to keep patients cancer-free once they go into remission. If you know anything about ovarian cancer, let's say you work in the infusion center, you'll see that patient, and you'll be all optimistic, and you should be, and that patient's going to respond. And then they come back, and they're like, what are you doing here? And so she recurred. So the goal is what we call maintenance treatment. Keep the patient in remission. Remission happens, but it's not sustainable. 85% of patients with advanced ovarian cancer recur. And if I know anything about anti-cancer therapy, as much as I like the infusion nurses, pills easier. So we have medications that are oral, which inhibit DNA repair, and that's what this slide shows. That little circle there is that we can go ahead and break the DNA with a pill. Isn't that interesting? And if we break the DNA, then the cell dies. So that's what a PARP inhibitor does. We can break the DNA, and we're more efficient in breaking the DNA if they can't repair the break. And the patients that can't repair a broken chromosome, or the tumors that can't repair a broken chromosome that you caused with this pill that's given in maintenance after the patient responds to frontline treatment, is a patient that has this homologous recombination repair deficient that can't, that's the fancy name for can't repair the break. And we can measure tumor cells if they can repair the DNA break that PARP inhibitors induce, and it's called an HRD test. And you can send it, there's several labs. These are the two FDA-approved tests, the one on the left and the one on the right. And frankly, it doesn't really matter. What matters is it gets done. What you said is that we need to test the cells in every body, the germline, and then we need to test the tumor. So that's what we do. And today, PARP inhibitors are restricted to the molecular signature populations, the HRD, the patients that can't repair the broken DNA that PARP inhibitors cause. And if you can't, or if you don't have a biomarker, then you should give bevacizumab. And if you have bevacizumab on board and you can have the biomarker, then you should get both. It's literally that simple. So that's what this says. So Dr. O'Malley said, you know, should a patient have a surgery? That's the first question. And it doesn't, it's complicated whether she should start with a surgery or have it interdigitated between the third and the fourth dose. Bevacizumab is probably a good option for almost all patients unless there's a contraindication, and then ultimately make this PARP decision. And the PARP decision is easy if the patient's tumor is HRD. And the only way you'll know it's HRD is if you send it to the lab and you test it. So that's the algorithm. And we can show the benefits here. These are called Kaplan-Meier curves. So you see at the beginning here, time zero, when the patient starts treatment, and this is a maintenance olaparib study, you can see that 100% of patients are alive. And over time, they die. And you see the months since randomization here at 5 years. And if they received a placebo, 63% are alive versus 71% are alive. And which curve would you rather be on? I'd rather be on that curve because there's a 10% survival advantage at 10 years, at 5 years. So this is called a Kaplan-Meier curve. And you can compare this curve to that curve, the ratio, and it's called a hazard ratio. And this is a 50.55 hazard ratio, which means, and you can do 0.55 minus 1, that this curve is 45%, 0.55 minus 1, better at any given time than that. So that is a Kaplan-Meier curve. Now, that was a long time ago. There was no crossover. Well, now, the other PARP inhibitor, that first one was olaparib given twice a day. This is niraparib given once a day. There's no survival advantage. And that's what, and maybe I was involved with this trial, that's what led to the restriction of only HRD. It was initially PARPs were for all comers, and it's true they work in all comers, but they work the best in the biomarker positive tumors, the tumors that can't repair the broken DNA. So ultimately, this is a combination. That's what we do, and you'll hear about it. We get a medication approved in late line. We move to earlier line. We use a combination here, bevacizumab and PARP. And then we go to other tumor types, and PARP inhibitors are used in ovarian, breast, prostate, and pancreas. So PARP inhibitors have been emblematic on how we do drug development today. So we have three PARP inhibitors in the clinic. There are three options: single agent olaparib twice daily, single agent niraparib once daily, and if you have a combination opportunity with bevacizumab, olaparib, bevacizumab, again, only in the HRD subset. So here is a case, and I really hate to show you this because this is what happens. Patient thinks she's a little indigestion, 56 years old, goes to the ER, and you know, in the ER, they barely examine you anymore. They just run you through the CAT scan. That's okay. And they run you through the CAT scan, and you can see this fluid here. This is the liver. This is fluid. And you see this cancer. This patient has an advanced cancer. And the CA125 is high. She feels good. Probably still working at the age of 56. Hypertension. Has maybe a family history. And again, we do germline testing no matter what the family history is. So what do? You biopsy it. So you biopsy it because you have to figure out, is this a GYN cancer or not? It could be colon cancer, pancreatic cancer. It could be recurrent breast cancer if she had a history. And find out what, not only is it GYN or not, but what kind. And the serous tumors, we have new treatments for low-grade serous tumors, which is rarer, and we're going to do molecular testing on the tumor. So you do that, and she doesn't have a BRCA mutation in the tumor. She is HRD, which is frankly good, because now I can give her a PARP. You can give her a PARP inhibitor, and we're going to hear a little bit about HER2. We do that in ovarian cancer. We're going to hear about folate receptor alpha. We do that in ovarian cancer. This would be a medium. This is a low, 3+ is high, and this would be a PD-L1 positive, which the threshold is 1. So the only thing that's really interesting here is HRD, and this patient is a good opportunity for carboplatin paclitaxel Bev, as you know how to do it all the time, and then we'll get a surgery, and then after the surgery, ultimately, is going to go ahead and add olaparib to the bevacizumab after the chemotherapy is completed in the maintenance phase to keep her in remission. So thanks, Dave, Dr. O'Malley, for letting me present that.
Wonderful. Thank you for a great start, because now we really have the baseline of some of the main questions that we have to ask. But a lot of what we're looking at is, so who... break it down for it. Who should absolutely get a PARP? Who should we strongly consider? Who should we maybe not be giving PARPs to with the data and as well as the FDA limitations?
So I said breast, pancreatic, prostate, and ovary. Four tumor types. Every single FDA indication requires a biomarker. So that's pretty simple. And the biomarker is called HRD. And it's basically, it assesses the inability of the tumor to repair the DNA breaks that PARP inhibitors cause. And so should everyone be considered? No. Should every HRD patient be considered? Yes. And again, if you're using bevacizumab, you should add it to it.
I love it. Great synopsis. But, you know, I disagree with you in one point.
Okay.
Earlier, you said infusion versus oral. You're right. People rather give oral, but oral medications are chemotherapy every day.
Yeah, I got it.
So Jacqueline is going to help us understand how to manage those symptoms and the opportunity that all of you have to help increase the chance these patients are cured. You showed, I know that's a scary word, 45% of patients HRD positive potentially are cured with utilization of olaparib or niraparib with or without BEV.
Advanced ovarian cancer cure. You got that, but you got to give a PARP inhibitor.
And you got to keep them on it.
Okay, let's
Jacqueline.
Go.
That's right. And he's exactly right. I mean, this is a medication that the patient has to take, you know, every day. And so, as you are well aware, you know, these PARP inhibitors can have side effects that come with it. And sometimes a patient calls our office about them, and sometimes they don't. And then we find out about it at their office visit. So it's really important from a nursing perspective to make sure your patient is educated up front in regards to what potential side effects that they may have and how to kind of deal with those side effects, making sure they have the right medications at home, the antiemetics, anti-diarrheas, and so we'll get into that in just a second here. So we have three PARP inhibitors, olaparib, niraparib, rucaparib, and as was stated before, you can do it with bevacizumab or not bevacizumab, and so those are the three PARP inhibitors, olaparib, niraparib, and again, rucaparib. So when do we start these medications? So optimal start time is about 4 to 6 weeks post last dose of chemotherapy. We really need to give enough time for the side effects from your chemotherapy to begin to recover, to ensure that, you know, we're giving that enough time, especially for your hematologic toxicities to recover, because PARP inhibitors do cause additional hematologic toxicities, especially in that first 3 months. And so ultimate time is about 4 to 6 weeks post last dose of chemotherapy, with a maximum window about 12 weeks in the first line maintenance setting. And then recurrent setting, no longer than about 8 weeks of that. And so with the olaparib, it's 300 milligrams, two tablets of 150 milligrams twice daily with or without food. There are dose reductions depending on the toxicity. Your first dose reduction is about 250 milligrams twice daily, and then your second dose reduction is 200 milligrams. Niraparib, you can give with or without food. This is something that you have to be really pay attention to with this particular drug. Okay, you have to, it's based on your platelets and how much the patient weighs. So that's kind of different. You know, we usually don't do weight-based dosing. That's like a pediatric thing, right? And so, but with this, though, we know that depending on how much the patient weighs and their platelets, we have to adjust the dose. So as you see here, if they weigh less than 170 or their platelets are less than 150, you do 200 milligrams. And then you see the dose reductions there on the slide. Also, be careful about hepatic impairment with this drug. Regardless of weight or platelets, you have to start with 200 milligram dose. The rucaparib, 600 milligrams twice daily, and then you see the dose reductions there in front of you. So, like I said, the first 3 months are the most time you're going to see the biggest side effects with these drugs. After that, they tolerate it usually pretty well, with usually some mild nausea and fatigue outside of that. But really, just educating them, like, I know you just got off chemotherapy, but you may still feel just as bad, unfortunately, with some of these drugs in regards to fatigue and nausea. And so just walking them through that, just ensuring that they are well aware of that. And if they feel like they need to stop the drug at home, please call us and we can help kind of get them through that first month or 3 months. So olaparib, nausea, fatigue, vomiting, anemia, neutropenia, niraparib, thrombocytopenia is a big thing. Hypertension is a big thing. So making sure that they have blood pressure monitor at home, watching their heart rate at home. They can have some dizziness and cough as well. Rucaparib, making sure that big thing with this is the liver enzymes can be elevated. And so if they're having any right upper quadrant pain, you know, give us a call. If their diarrhea is not controlled, nausea not controlled, again, just making sure that they call us and let us know. And then on your laboratory values with rucaparib, their creatinine can also be increased. So just some things to kind of look at when you're looking at labs. So let's talk about safety information, warning, and precautions. These aren't benign drugs, and so there's no contraindication in regards to giving them, but they do have some warnings out there. There is a small, rare risk of MDS and AML, and so monitoring their hematologic toxicities is really important for that, even after they have completed a therapy. After the completed maintenance, I have a physician that will continue to monitor their CBCs even after they're done with their treatment. Pneumonitis, it's really small, rare, of course, embryo-fetal toxicity, hepatotoxicity, including some liver injury with niraparib. I don't see that very often, but it is there. Again, niraparib can have the same MDS, AML risk factor. They have, of course, bone marrow suppression. They have this rare press precaution as well. So if the patient calls and they're having headaches and or their family members calls and, you know, mom not really acting right. She's having these altered mental status changes. She's having some issues with her eyes. We got to think about this rare toxicity with niraparib. And then again, I'll point out just the photosensitivity with rucaparib. Make sure that you're educating your patients on wearing sungreen, protective clothing, hats when outdoors. Key monitoring is in making sure that you are monitoring their CBCs and CBCs and CMPs weekly, because their counts can go down. They may need blood. They're thrombocytopenic, and you know they, God forbid, they would need a platelet transfusion to get so low. But we need to catch these things early, and so educating those patients, hey, you know, you're going to come in every week, and you're going to get blood, and we're going to give you a call. Make sure you have your phone on. Make sure your voicemail is not, you know, full. Those are the simple things that can help, you know, contact those patients when we're trying to manage their toxicity. So those things that we necessarily don't think about educating, we do need to. And then, again, the rucaparib, just making sure they're monitoring their blood pressure and their heart rate. You may need to hold or dose reduce depending on the level of the toxicity. I kind of went over this earlier. This is patient education, so I'll skip over that. This is a case study here. So this is a 50-year-old African-American female, G1, P1. She kind of the typical ovarian cancer, hypertension, obesity, hypercholesterolemia. Family history, her mother and maternal aunt had both had breast cancer in their 60s, lived with her husband. She presented to her PCP with complaints of abdominal pain, constipation for several months, usually very typical symptoms here. Was CT scan was found to have a large 10.5 centimeter pelvic mass and had not seen her gynecologic provider in several years. Her CA125 was elevated and she was referred to us for further evaluation. She was scheduled for tumor debulking and was resected to no gross residual disease. She had germline and tumor testing and was found to be BRCA1 positive. She was counseled on starting carboplatin and paclitaxel for 6 cycles. Overall, she tolerated treatment well, but did need to undergo a blood transfusion for anemia prior to cycle 6. So when you see that, you have to think about when we start this PARP inhibitor, you may have a trouble with anemia because she had a bone marrow suppression that required, you know, blood transfusion up in the upfront setting. So her CAT scan looked good. She was NAD. CA125 is normal now. After cycle number 6, her hemoglobin was 8.3 with some grade 1 to 2 fatigue. And she was counseled on starting olaparib 300 milligrams twice daily for 2 years. Her hemoglobin 5 weeks after her last infusion was 10.3, and she felt ready to start olaparib with some mild grade 1 fatigue. So we monitor her weekly labs. We do her CBC, CMP, but week 2 of her olaparib, her hemoglobin did drop to 7.8. Okay, she was at risk for doing that because she needed one in her upfront therapy. So we gave her 2 units of blood, and her olaparib was held. She was dose-reduced 1 level to 250 BID, and she continued weekly labs until her anemia was grade 1. At her 1 month follow-up, she had a little bit of fatigue and some nausea. She was forgetting to take her antiemetics. Okay, and so again, education, making sure that they have those available and taking those. At her 2 month follow-up, her nausea was better tolerated, and she was controlled with her antiemetics. So it's really important. Again, you know, she could have been saying that I don't want to do this. You know, PARP inhibitor is making me so nauseous. But again, just educating and making sure we can get them past that 3 months. So at a 3 month follow-up, she's doing well. Her labs were continuing to be grade 1, and her CAT scan was NAD, and her CO25 was normal. Ultimately, she finished her 2 years of PARP inhibitor. She's NAD, she's in surveillance, doing great. Her CO25 is normal, and her daughter did undergo testing with that BRCA1, and she is negative. So she's done great. She is NAD, and that's what we want for our patients. Like he said, you know, our goal is to have a complete response, and like she did, and the PARP inhibitor has been working. So
Jacqueline, she made it through 2 years of therapy. She's at 1 year surveillance. She's at 3 years from clean primary therapy. Her risk of recurrence is down to probably 3 to 5% per year. It's not zero.
Yeah.
Those first 3 years. So there's a very good chance her cancer is not coming back.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. So exciting.
And why? Because you kept her on therapy.
Yeah.
Right? So Katie, Neil asked me this question every time. So this particular patient had anemia. That's why I think we did a olaparib single agent, because niraparib is known a little bit more hematologic, but niraparib is only once a day. We don't really have rucaparib in the U.S. There's ways to get, but anyway. So do you have a preference on which PARP inhibitor you utilize?
Yeah, in our practice, you know, we utilize olaparib and rucaparib. I would say in general, in practice, we've seen that olaparib is a little bit easier with some of the side effects. Niraparib, you've got to take into consideration those weekly labs. But it's kind of up to the patient scenario. So one thing that came to mind when you were giving your presentation was a patient of mine who is a Jehovah's Witness. And so you would think, you know, you hear that and you think, oh, surgery is high risk. PARP inhibitors would be high risk. Things that may potentially require a blood transfusion could be high risk. But we just took it on a case-by-case basis. We did put her on a PARP inhibitor. We did olaparib, but we did a much lower starting dose. So we did modify a little bit, but we wanted her to have access to this because she is HR deficient, and we wanted her to receive the benefit from the therapy as well.
So, Brad, you taught me this early on. Take it with food.
Right.
Take the PARP inhibitor with the food. Very quickly, any final comments about the PARP inhibitors?
No, I think it's rooted, though, in testing, and we're going to get into mirvetuximab soravtansine, which is a folate receptor alpha antibody-drug conjugate. You're going to hear about it. And you're not going to use it unless you test. So I think this is some thematic learning. You can test the tumor for HR deficient or HRD, and now you can test it for folate receptor alpha.
Perfect. We're going to switch gears a little bit from primary to now the recurrent setting. So we're going to talk about folate receptor alpha that Brad just nicely introduced. Talk a little bit about MIRV, the new drug, and he says it, mirvetuximab soravtansine. I'm not that smart. I call it MIRV. All right? So we're going to call it MIRV throughout here. And we're going to talk about the indication, but also some of the other data which we've seen. Now, in an antibody-drug conjugate, you have the target. So you have to be differentially expressed on the cancer as you are in versus normal cells. And then you have the payload. That's what's brought, once you have the connection with your antibody, you have the payload which is brought into the cell and then activated, delivering chemotherapy. It's still chemotherapy. smarter, more personalized chemotherapy, but still chemotherapy. We know folate receptor alpha is expressed in about 8% of patients with ovarian cancer, but only about a third is expressed highly. And this shows, I'm a very visual person, I'm a surgeon at heart, so visual. On the left is low, on the right is high, dark brown, light brown, right? And so we use these 2+ testing, you'll hear that, you may hear some different testing in the future, but right now this is our standard testing. On the far right is really the breakdown of the expression levels across low, medium, and high. So we have about 1/3 of patients will be highly expressed, but about 2/3 will be medium or high. And then a very small percentage is really less than 1%, less than 10%. So it's really up to 90% have some expression. And we're testing that on some of our new drugs that we'll get to. This is really what I've already talked about, which is an antibody-drug conjugate, where we saw what was first considered, what first was accelerated approval. We had exposure to the ability, not the exposure, we had the ability to get the drug before the big phase 3 trial was completed. And with the very exciting results of the phase 3 trial, we had essentially been all of our lifetimes had never shown a survival advantage in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer until MIRASOL, which was MIRV in high folate receptor alpha expression versus standard of care, paclitaxel, pegylated doxorubicin, or topotecan. And it looked like a very typical ovarian cancer, 1 to 3 priors, platinum-resistant, okay? But they had to be highly expressed. But as I said, we previously had been OFER. Baseball season, OFER, mean you didn't get any hits in that game, right?
OFER.
For the first time, we saw clear advantage in overall survival. And so you see this improvement, marked improvement, again, by about a third, almost 40%. But we also saw patients responding at 42% met RECIST response, while the standard arm, only 16% met that response. And there were some toxicities, and we're going to talk more about those toxicities as we go through. But quickly, the hematologic toxicity of MIRV compared to our standard chemotherapy is actually better. When we look at peripheral neuropathy, these patients are on an antimicrotubulin, a paclitaxel-like drug, and so you will see neuropathy, particularly for those who are on chronic for a long time. But we also see some GI. The differentiated seems to be MIRV, but if you look at MIRV versus paclitaxel, very similar. Very low rates of stomatitis. And you do see some nausea. You should use prophylactic and make sure they have rescue. The big issue is about half the patients will have some eye toxicity and symptoms. We're going to get into that more in the next talk. But at the same time we were testing the single agent of MIRV, we were doing a lot of work with combination. One of the combinations that we utilized was with Bev. And we see here what we called Forward 2, and I was honored to lead this trial, that we had response rates which approached 50% on the high folate receptor alpha expression. But even in the lows, the expression levels exceeded 35%. So because of this trial, we actually had NCCN guideline listing. And when we looked at this, we also enrolled patients who had platinum-sensitive disease, who we thought would be appropriate for non-platinum. And those patients we see on the, the green, the far right to the green, is we see response rates which, again, approached 50%. So we saw, with a combination of Bev, responses across all expression levels, with response platinum-sensitive and platinum-resistant, ultimately leading to NCCN guidelines. And again, we're going to talk more about the toxicities. For time's sake, I'm not going to go through that. But because the data that we found in the platinum sensitive, we said, you know what, we should test this independently just with MIRV by itself in patients who are eligible for platinum but you may not want to give it, hypersensitivity or bad hematologic previous toxicity. This was led by our friend Dr. Angelos Alvarez-Secord, once again showed now 52% responses in platinum sensitive by itself, not carboplatin plus MIRV, but by itself. And we saw good activity in across all subgroups if they're treated with a PARP inhibitor or not. This is one of my favorite patients, and if I get a little choked up on this, because this is an amazing story. Ashley presented originally in 2013 and had a biopsy, ultimately had treatment, recurred 4 years later, proven biopsy, and had a platinum doublet at that time. Genetic testing and somatic testing didn't really give us much that we had actionable. She was treated with a clinical trial out east, actually lived about 3.5 hours from Columbus, and found us with regards to the trial with MIRV and Bev. She was the last patient to enter onto that Forward 2 trial. So that was in January of 2019. We treated her for over a year and a half before we had to dose reduce her because of neuropathy, again, a chronic toxicity. She continued to receive therapy for a total of 2 years on trial, where they closed the trial. At that point, we were able to get a compassionate use, and she was maintained then again until another almost 2 years. 4 years on MIRV-BEV when she finally said, I need a holiday. At that point, we were expecting MIRV to get approved, and unfortunately, she presented with brain mets then about a year and a half later. But you see a marked improvement here where the red arrow circles are showing that on the left is before she was treated and we essentially had a complete response. And this is her. Patty was amazing. This was her interview, so she had given us permission. But I never had children of her own, but she had a lot of furry children. And so she would make the 300-mile trip to Columbus each day, for each cycle. And we ultimately lost her in July. But amazing story. Was on treatment for almost 4 years with MIRV-BEV. And so really pretty impressive what we're now seeing with clinical trials. So, Brad, who should I test?
Yes.
Everybody.
Yes.
That's your way of saying everybody?
That's my way. And again, this is the theme, right? You test everyone. I love it. That's what you said. Who should you test? You said everyone. Mm-hmm. So we need to test. We only test the germline, the cells that were born with once. You can test the tumor repeatedly if you have tissue in hand. But yes, you should test. And it's amazing to me how many people forget. So that's what I want you to do, is have a take-home message. And again, We're your nurses. Your opportunity is to facilitate. So when you're in clinic with your whoever, gynecologic oncologist, medical oncologist, say, oh, did that biomarker testing come back? Oh, I didn't order it. It's a little monk sarcasm, but you get the point.
Actually, that was really, really kind of dull for your sarcasm. I mean, usually it's much more overt than that. But I think it's a great way to look at it, right? Did you have germline testing? Did you have next-generation sequence? Did you have folate at HER2? This is a great opportunity to be an advocate for your patients. Katie, you know, I know you've used a fair amount of MIRV. Becca is one of the docs you work with. She has a neoadjuvant clinical trial. So, you know, instead of asking the question, why don't we just get right into the symptoms?
Yeah, I was going to say a lot of this will come up in just a minute. so that's perfect. All right. And just before I dive in, a comment about the impact that nurses can have on ordering testing. So Melissa is a nurse that works with actually both of my doctors that I'm in clinic with, and she has their chart open, and when they're coming and we're trying to figure out what their next line of therapy is going to be, she's already got the genetic testing tab open. She can tell us what they've had. One of my physicians will ask, and she's like, no, we did it in September of 2024, maybe it's been a long time and we want to do that updated testing. Maybe folate receptor alpha wasn't part of their initial somatic tumor testing. So
on my chart check, it says on the appointment, needs molecular testing.
Ah.
So I'm like, just, love it. Just to kind of motivate me a little bit.
Yes. Okay, so mirvetuximab, we've talked about, is an antibody-drug conjugate that targets folate receptor alpha. We've talked a little bit about the expression. It's got one current FDA approval, and that's for use as monotherapy in tumors that express at a rate of 75% or higher. So that's what we consider high. But then kind of getting back to that question, that's not the only situation where we use MIRV. So like Dr. O'Malley just showed us, there is certainly activity when you combine it with bevacizumab. So I've got a lot of patients who actually fit into these three different categories, and I've seen it give them more years of life with their families. I've got some that are completely in remission at the moment who have had a complete response. Others didn't have a complete response, but again, they got that longer time. So I think it's really important, number one, to do this testing, which we've said a million times, but really the reason why that's important is so that our patients have the opportunity to receive treatments that may work the very best for their specific tumor. That's why we do it. And so in the NCCN guidelines do have using bevacizumab in 25% or higher expressors in the platinum-resistant setting, and then in that platinum-sensitive setting at 50% or higher. It's given once every 3 weeks, so it's pretty similar to a lot of the other chemotherapy regimens that we give. We use typical pre-medications with antiemetics, steroids, Benadryl, and Tylenol. But let's get into the toxicities. So in the gyn-onc space, we didn't really deal with ocular toxicities much at all. We're talking about mirvetuximab right now, and then we also have tisotumab vedotin that we can use in cervical cancer. And those are the two medications or treatment options that we've had in recent years that have gotten approvals for our patients where they can cause ocular toxicity. And so that can sound really scary to a patient, especially patients in the recurrent setting who have been getting therapies in the gyn-onc space for ovarian cancer and other gynecologic malignancies, and now all of a sudden, you know, they're used to the nausea, vomiting, the neuropathy, the, you know, the GI side effects, but now you're throwing in ocular toxicity, and we saw in the beginning that that was really scary for our patients, and actually some of our providers, you know, it's an uncomfortable thing wondering what are we about to cause with these agents. So here I've listed some of the most common ocular adverse effects that our patients with MIRV experience. Blurred vision is by and large the most common thing that I talk about with patients. You can have keratopathy or keratitis, which is inflammation involving the outer epithelium of the eye. It is temporary. That does regenerate. So that's an important teaching point that I speak to patients about. And then we use the help of the ophthalmologist to do an eye exam and tell us if that inflammation is present, how severe is it? So with the keratitis, you can have confluent or non-confluent, and that is just an exam finding that tells you how widespread or how involved is that inflammation. And as providers, that helps me figure out if I need to dose reduce a patient or delay their therapy. It helps the eye doctor know if they might need to change up how they're doing their eye drops. And then some of my patients report dry eyes, a little bit of light sensitivity and eye pain, although those are much less common than some of the others there. It's also important to note that a lot of these are grade 1 to 2, so it's not a reason to stop therapy. We want to keep patients on treatment. So I always say, at the first sign of something, please call the nurse's line. Please send a portal message. Let me know what's happening. It's not the end of the world if I need to reduce your dose or if I need to hold it, because in the long run, that's going to keep us from having to delay your therapy. We rarely take patients off for that side effect. And usually after cycle 2, maybe around cycle 2 or 3 is when I see a lot of that happen. So I mentioned that they go see the eye doctor. They get a baseline ocular exam. So it's a visual acuity and a slit lamp examination. And then they will get that eye exam every other visit for the first 8 cycles. And then you can do it as clinically indicated. If they're not having issues, I don't quit the eye exams, but I will allow them to space it out a little bit further. And then, like I mentioned earlier, there's actually an ocular assessment form that they take to their eye doctor. So we don't just get a clinic note. It's a dedicated form that has information on it that is showing those specific effects that MIRV can cause that we need to know, are they there? And then if they are, how severe are they? Because again, that impacts what we do with their treatment. All patients on mirvetuximab will use prophylactic eye drops. So that's going to include lubricating eye drops and steroid eye drops. Preservative-free lubricating eye drops is very important. And then there's a schedule that they would do the steroid eye drops on. And if they start to have issues, their eye doctor may increase that schedule a little bit. And then just some helpful measures. For our patients who wear contacts, we ask them to avoid wearing contact lenses. So that's one of those things that if you wear contacts all day, going back to glasses might be a bit of a change, but we do recommend that. It helps. And then using sunglasses when you're in the sun, and some warm compresses can help in the evening. Pneumonitis is a side effect that's more rare, but it certainly can happen. In the trial that I used to create these slides, 1% were grade 3. There was one patient with grade 4, but pneumonitis is a side effect where, if you remember one thing, it's so early to intervene early on. So the symptoms can be really written off as many different things. They can come in with cough, shortness of breath, hypoxia. They can have a fever. You might be thinking respiratory viral infection, pneumonia. So you really just need to do a workup. We get high resolution chest CTs. That shows a little more detail and helps the radiologist tell you if they think there are findings that are suggestive of pneumonitis. You do want to make sure that it's not just a respiratory infection. We certainly hold therapy until their symptoms have improved. And we often utilize steroid tapers and pulmonary function tests. Neuropathy is something else that can happen when patients are on MIRV. Oftentimes, they've also seen Taxol or paclitaxel as part of their prior chemotherapy, so you have a lot of pre-existing neuropathy with these patients, and so mirvetuximab, especially if they're on it for a long time, can kind of have a compounded effect on that. And then there are some other general side effects that we think of, similar to other chemotherapies as well.
So Katie, you have a great example here. You have a 77-year-old recurrent ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. And you said, again, great drug, trying to keep him on trial. So you have a patient with grade 2 at cycle 6, keratopathy, and some blurred vision. Were you able to keep her on treatment? What were some of the things that you did to keep her on therapy?
Absolutely. So I did hold her therapy. I had her go back for an eye exam. After a period of time, I did not restart or resume that sixth cycle until her keratopathy had gotten back down to a grade 1 or less, and then she was able to finish out that therapy, had her post-treatment scan, had a complete response, and was able to continue on in a maintenance phase with the mirvetuximab and the bevacizumab. I actually just saw her at an ovarian cancer gala that we had, and she's in ED right now, came up to me. It was great, but it has allowed her to go back to living her life. She's very involved with our local organization, and she's doing great, we have the mirvetuximab to thank for that.
So for the infusion nurses in the room, the clinic nurses, cycle 2, day 10 to 14. Mm-hmm. It's when they'll wake up and say, I'm having blurred vision. It can happen anytime, but that is the largest occurrence. It's very, very consistent. Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Monk, Brad, so you have, I mean, who are you? You're testing everybody. Mm-hmm. Are you sticking with the FDA label? Are you treating people lower than 75%?
The questions are getting tougher. So one of the...
Neil's whispering in my ear.
Is he? Yeah. Really?
No.
He's probably, go get him, Dave. Go get him, Dave. But the point is that we have several options here. Mm-hmm. So we have MIRV. We're going to talk about relacorilant, this cortisol blocker. We're going to talk about immunotherapy. So I think all of that has to be considered. I have a tendency to practice more on label based on my structure and the guardrails that I have. So generally, I do not treat very many 2-plus patients. I also want to say Dr. O'Malley here runs the GOG portfolio for ovarian cancer. So I would be remiss, he'd probably hammer me even further, that's a good patient for a clinical trial. So, and if you don't have a clinical trial at your site, well, you can come talk to us later. But clinical trial is the number one option for these patients, not only, and thank you, by the way, your patient went on a clinical trial. That's beautiful.
Yes.
I was impressed. So the short answer is not very often. I prescribe generally based on the label.
Yeah, I think the opportunity, so great segue in clinical trials. You know, we're going to talk a lot about clinical trials here in the next few minutes, right? Because we see a lot of exciting new agents. What we call DESTINY-PanTumor02 was actually the TDXD trial. This was kind of an umbrella trial where they treated multiple solid tumors. And what we found is we saw activity across all of the tumors they tested except for pancreatic, but particularly in the GYN cancers. And on the right there in the ovarian, you have a 64% response rate, small number of patients, 11, but actually the FDA gave TDXD an agnostic approval for 3+ HER2, 3+, the really brown one in those squares I showed you. Now, very small numbers in ovary, but exciting. And we have a clinical trial with regards to trying to answer this question in the first line setting, as a matter of fact. Now, it's also important if you do the math here that the 2+ was 36, but all comers were 45. So, you know, we saw activity across all expression levels, 1, 2, and even some zeros, but we'll talk about that. So, you know, when I look at this, who should be tested, right? Yes. I love that answer, right? Who should be tested? So, folate receptor alpha, HER2, okay? The opportunities for us to educate our patients with regards to the need for clinical trial, for testing of their tissue, not just if the molecular mutations are there, but are the proteins expressed, and that's the IHC testing.
So there are three tests, right? So we're going to get to the PD-L1, but you've already taught us that we need to test for folate receptor alpha, HER2, and it's 3, and it's not NGS. NGS is looking at the DNA, and so I liked what you said, Dave, that this is immunohistochemistry. Sometimes it's even able to be done at your hospital.
Love it. Jacqueline, you start a patient on TDXD. What's some of the things you really tell that patient who is starting on TDXD?
Yeah, so there are some, you know, really important patient education in regards to TXD. So pneumonitis is one of the big ones. And so if they begin to have shortness of breath, they're having cough, they need to make sure that they contact their clinic in an early fashion and not just say, oh, it's probably allergies or, oh, you know, I may be getting, you know, a little virus. Those things need to be reported very quickly to the office, and we'll need to rule out that they don't have a viral infection, that they don't have just an upper respiratory issue. But that's really important because these patients can go down very quickly, and we'll need to start them on treatment and therapy in regards to like some steroid taper. So.
And so the pneumonitis, you know, not that rare, but can be very serious.
Yes.
And we've all had patients who have unfortunately died from there, right? About 1% right now, and the past is as high as 2% because I don't think we recognized it. So, Brad, it was a great segue when you talk about clinical trials because we have a number of these antibody-drug conjugates with a TOPO1 payload. Mm-hmm. So different than MIRV, which is an antimicrotubulin, a TOPO1 payload. Could you briefly, we're a little tight on time, briefly go through some of those, and then I know you had another comment to make.
Well, I wanted to make that comment because, get this, the side effect profile is not the target. It's not HER2, it's not folate receptor alpha. It's what's attached, conjugated to the antibody. It's the drug, antibody-drug conjugate. So it's the drug that creates the side effect. and the paclitaxel-like, the tubulin-like medications are more neuropathy. We all know that paclitaxel causes neuropathy. The topoisomerase chemotherapy that's attached to the antibody, which you call a topoisomerase inhibitor, is occasionally pneumonitis, but routinely emetogenicity. It's nausea. So trastuzumab deruxtecan is more emetogenic. It needs highly emetogenic prophylaxis, the three or four medications. It's also more marrow-suppressive, so they need more growth factors. Side effect is not the target. It's the chemotherapy that's conjugated. So we're not done yet, and one of our very exciting targets is CDH6, and it's the same payload as trastuzumab deruxtecan TDXT, so guess what? The side effects are a bit similar. So we're trying to move forward. We have a phase 2-3 trial. We don't have a chance to talk very much about clinical trials, but we're now required to figure out what the right dose is, because you may not need to give the right the higher dose. The lower dose may be enough. So you can see this is three different doses that have been interrogated, and now it's a randomized phase 3 trial. So this is one of our very, I wouldn't say favorite. I have several kids. They're all the same. I like them all the same. But this is, Dave has five. But this is one of our clinical trials. This is what we call a waterfall plot. So this is the baseline volume of the cancer. Okay? So this is baseline. Everybody starts at the same. And as the tumor shrinks, maybe even to minus 100%, that's called a complete response. And if it gets down to here, that's 30%, you see, 30% tumor shrinkage. That's a partial response. If it gets above here, that's called progression. So it's a 20% progression, the total volume, 30% partial response, complete response. This is what success looks like. Basically, all of these patients are having tumor shrinkage. All of these patients are having partial responses, and all of these patients here are having complete responses. And again, this is the deruxtecan payload that's part of trastuzumab, but the antibody is called raludotug, and it's against CDH6. So we're not done yet, and we'll have several antibody-drug conjugate studies thanks to Dr. Womaly's great leadership.
Well, you know, I tell you, we have... Right now, I met with our operations from GOG Partner. We have 20 clinical trials that we're developing in ovarian cancer, just ovarian, not endometrial cervix. And when we look at these opportunities for our patients, this next generation, which you just introduced us, we have eight others we could have talked about. It really gives us excitement that we are going to turn this disease into chronic disease. And we have two new indications. Brad's going to talk about one. I'm going to talk about this one, relacorilant. And we're going to talk a little bit about, you've already alluded to it, right? The glucocorticoid, but cortisol, right? How important is cortisol? We see it both in our circulating, but as well as at the tumor.
Yeah.
So on the left is actually looking and measuring people with night cortisol levels. And just that... Just the cortisol levels in patients with ovarian cancer had markedly shorter survivals the higher your levels were. And then we looked at, not we, actually Catalarusa, who from Italy, looked at expression levels in the tumor. And if you had glucocorticoid receptor at a higher level, patients did worse. So, and the tumor and in our body is a negative predictor. Now, relacorilant, which is a selective glucocorticoid receptor antagonist, probably has three or four different mechanisms of actions. And we always think we know the mechanisms of actions, but the reality is we're not exactly sure. But relacorilant appears to overcome chemotherapy resistance through a series of mechanisms that code for these anti-death, anti-apoptotic proteins. But I think one of the even bigger impacts it has is decreasing cortisol, decreasing your anti-immune response, which cortisol high cortisol blunts our body's immune response. So by blocking that, we're allowing the body's immune system to do what it should do. And so we tested that in a large phase 3 trial with nab-paclitaxel. Nab-paclitaxel, so different than paclitaxel. We use this a lot in patients with hypersensitivity. And why did we do that? Because we didn't need steroids. And all patients received the nab-paclitaxel weekly 3 out of 4 weeks. How many of us do paclitaxel? And with that, the day before, the day of, and the day after, 3 days with each infusion, they received the relacorilant, this glucocorticoid receptor antagonist. And when we look at this, the response, the impact was marked. But first we need to look at what was this group of patients? 1 to 3 prior, very similar to our other clinical trials we've discussed. A little bit more, a higher risk. We allowed patients to go on if they recurred very shortly after completing their primary therapy. But 1 to 3 priors with a series of other treatments. And our first view of this, we showed progression-free survival with a 30% improvement. You see clear separation of those curves at the first disease assessment at 2 months, where that green arrow is, and then persist. But the most exciting part, and the reason I emphasize the immunomodulatory effects of this agent, is in the overall survival final analysis just presented a few weeks ago at our annual meeting. And you look at the tails of those curves. Not only do we see a 35% response rate, improvement in the overall survival, you see separation at the tails of the curve, a telltale sign, no pun intended, of immune therapy. And we have platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, we have separation of these, and we'll see something similar when Dr. Monk presents his data. Nab-paclitaxel is not used that commonly in ovarian cancer. We were somewhat concerned that the response rate would not be what we saw in regular weekly paclitaxel. But we saw exactly where we'd expect it, with patients responding at about 30% response. That went up to about 37% if we had relacorilant. And what's amazing about this trial and what Brad's going to present is the control arms. Remember in Mirasol, I said weekly paclitaxel, but also PLD and topo? Well, we know those aren't quite as good. We didn't have time to get into that today. But the weekly taxanes are the best regimens we have for platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. And interestingly, we didn't see much difference at all with regards to toxicities as that you'd expect with nab-paclitaxel weekly. Maybe slightly increased hematologic toxicity. There's some other things we were talking about the other day with some rash and some other question mark. But really, when we look at it, it's quite well tolerated. So this brings me to my case. This is actually, she's the mother of two physicians. And she came in as received carboplatin paclitaxel Bev, total of 8 cycles. She had tumor reductive surgery after 4, achieved a complete response and was on Bev for 15 cycles, but then recurred. We treated with carboplatin gen Bev and unfortunately progressed after 3 cycles and had an acute worsening of her kidney function. So now I have a patient who is secondary platinum refractory and progressed just after 3 cycles. Pretty bad prognostic. She had less than 25% expression on her folate receptor and nothing on her two. Her PD-L1, interestingly, was positive. I should have included that. And because she was not a candidate for Bev with her kidney function, this decision about which choice to make was a little bit more clear for me, and Brad will get into but she did receive relacorilant and nab-paclitaxel. She actually just started last week. So for the group, you know, when you hear this with regards to the cortisol, glucocorticoid reception expression, I mean, is this something that resonates with your patients? Is this something that they're interested in?
Yes, absolutely. I know recent approval and things like that, but Absolutely. I think at a basic level, when I'm talking to patients about this and trying to help them understand how it works, giving a medication that can help your treatment work better and help your body's own immune system fight the cancer, I mean, that's kind of a win in their book, and that's exciting to hear. So, you know, I think we have patients who are, you know, doing weekly paclitaxel, weekly Abraxane. And so, yeah, this is one more thing, but it's got a unique component to the treatment regimen that's exciting and encouraging for them to hear.
And I think we're going to wait on some of these questions that you present B96, Brad, because I think that would be a more interesting discussion. But Jacqueline, you know, you when we talk about these new agents, this is brand new. I mean, it's literally approved, what, last
March
month?
25th.
Thank you. March 25th, a month and a half ago. So this is a great opportunity for our nursing colleagues in the room to really help in the education, get people excited. So why don't you tell us about some of the tolerability considerations?
Yeah, like they were saying before, like it's an ideal combination partner because the nab-paclitaxel doesn't need steroids, which is going to suppress your immune system, right? And so we put these two drugs together to, again, increase the your own body's ability to really fight this cancer. So it really basically relacorilant, it antagonizes the effect of glucocorticoids. So if you add systemic glucocorticoids, it makes it less effective. And then similarly, the co-administration may make relacorilant less effective. So essentially they negate each other, and it can, produce, autoimmune disorders to exacerbate. So you have to be really careful in regards to, giving relacorilant with, to someone who already has this autoimmune disorder and they're taking steroids for. So you have to be really careful in regards to making sure you know your patient's medical history in regards to giving this drug as well. And then it is contraindicating in patients who are receiving systemic glucocorticoids for life-saving purposes like immunosuppressions after organ transplant. So something to think about when you are making those treatment discussions. So dosing your nab-paclitaxel, we give it at 80. It's an IV infusion, day 1, day 8, and day 15 of every 28-day cycle. Your relacorilant is 150 milligrams. It's given the day before, day of, and day after each infusion. You take it with food, swallow the whole capsules. This is important at patient education. So missed doses, it is an oral medication. And so if you miss a dose and it's less than 12 hours, you take the missed dose. If it's over 12 hours, you skip the missed dose and do not take two doses at the same time to make up for those missed doses. If vomiting occurs, do not take an additional dose. So just really good to review that with patients before they start taking the medication. Like I said, it's very well tolerated and very manageable. There's no new safety concerns with this drug. Some of the most common adverse reactions is going to be your laboratory abnormalities, anemia, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, can have some rash, fatigue, nausea, decreased appetite, and diarrhea. You may need to hold versus omit based upon the grade and the day of the infusion. So if you're holding nab-paclitaxel, you also need to hold relacorilant. You can continue same dose of relacorilant when you resume the nab-paclitaxel unless you have like a more severe grade 3 or grade 4 hematologic toxicity. Here is some dose reductions in regards to nab-paclitaxel. If your first reduction, you would just reduce it to 60. Second reduction, you're just going to basically omit day 8. And then if you have to have a third dose reduction, we need to permanently discontinue that. The reduction in the relacorilant is not often, but it seems to be done if you're having fatigue, loss of appetite. And then if you have to dose reduce it again, you're going to permanently discontinue that. So let's get into a little bit more of the warning and precautions. Neutropenia and severe infections. There has been severe neutropenia and febrile neutropenia reported. Making sure that you monitor these patients with CBCs before each weekly infusion and then as clinically indicated. Again, we may need to dose reduce versus delay. And a significant a number of patients may needed to add a growth factor to that with either cycle one or cycle two. So just really paying attention to those laboratory values, educating the patients on the most important part is getting those CBCs done before each weekly infusion because we're trying to avoid hospitalization and getting them really sick and end up in the hospital. So we're trying to prevent that happening with the growth factor. Some also just rare but notable warnings is adrenal insufficiency. It is reversible. It can happen at any time during the treatment. It can happen usually when you're at stress, so acute illness, infection, surgery. We need to monitor signs and symptoms because serum cortisol levels do not provide an accurate assessment with these patients. So educating, again, patients in regards to are they having fatigue that's long-lasting, muscle weakness, sudden severe pain in their lower back, dizziness, hypotension, confusion. So just really these rare side effects, but we really need to be educated upon that as nurses. If they call the clinic and they're having these things, we have to think about those rare instances where there is adrenal insufficiency. If it is suspected, we do need to hold that and administer glucocorticoid therapy. High doses may be required, and then sometimes we can resume at previous doses or dose reduce based upon the severity of those. So another warning and precautions of exacerbations of conditions treated with glucocorticoids. It is a substrate of CYP3A and CY2C8. Specific populations, we're likely not going to have a patient with lactation. But avoid during that for about a week after the last dose. Pay attention to this one, geriatric use, you're going to get higher incidence of grade 3 and 4 adverse events and need to use dose modifications in that. So just knowing that we have a lot of patients, that's our general population, 65-year-old. So they're going to have higher rates of those AEs. And then hepatic impairment, avoid administering those and monitor severe hepatic impairment. So watching, those laboratory values.
So let's take that for a second. So, you know, we don't take care of at a sodium crisis, right? So I was just talking with who makes that drug, and they said they've actually never seen what patients present in hypotension, change in mental status. But it did make in the label, so we need to educate. Because I think, again, we sometimes see this when we go outside of clinical trials, we see things we've never seen before. So your case is part of the challenges that we have as clinicians, that this 67-year-old is at home taking care of her husband who's battling with dementia, and you have to say, well, now I need you to come in weekly for your treatment. And that was really challenging for her. Can you tell us, and you decided to actually put her on relacorilant. You talked about the risk and benefits. She had primary platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, very poor prognosis. So how are some of the things you did when you managed her, and how did you talk about dose reduction as well as overcoming some of the challenges with getting her in weekly?
Yeah, and so with cycle one and day 15, her ANCU was 890. And so at this particular time, we needed to omit the paclitaxel, start her on growth factor, and hold the recurlent. Her ANC did recover with the CBC prior to cycle two. And then we started at the same dose. With cycle number two, she didn't have any further dose adjustments that needed or didn't need to omit anything. Her grade one fatigue and nausea was controlled with antiemetics, and her previous neuropathy was stable. So again, just importance of lab monitoring and really holding the doses when appropriate and dose reduction is going to ultimately allow them to continue on treatment. That's what we want for our patients.
Yeah, we have that break, so we can give them OBI or G-CSF at that day 15, which then gives them on day one. I'd love to talk more about this. New agents are very exciting. Brad, speaking of not a new agent, but a new clinical trial, again, overall survival advantage. Can you please tell us a little bit about our options here utilizing IO in ovarian cancer?
Yeah, thank you. I was sitting there thinking, this is the fourth time that the GYN oncology community has brought a new agent to oncology. Number one, paclitaxel. Number two, PARP inhibitors. Number three, MIRV. Number four, relacorilant. And we're accelerating. It was 22 years between the first and the second. It was 8 years between PARP and MIRV. It was 4 years between MIRV and relacorilant. And it will continue to accelerate. So immunotherapy is nothing new, but it's new to ovarian cancer. So thank you for your stories trying to extend that. Again, this is the CA-125 this time. Extend the first remission, maybe even cure them. Love the stories. But ultimately, as the patient becomes resistant to the most active agents, it's a tragedy. It's panic. And we used to say it's chemotherapy resistant. It's not. It's just platinum resistant. So I think, and I always say this, that you got to know yourself. What does that even mean? Your immune system has to know itself. Your immune system or the patient's immune system thinks that the cancer is them. It's actually the enemy. Okay? Self, well-ordered, non-self pathogens. It doesn't think that the patient's cancer is a pathogen. So this balance between what is self and which is non-self is the trick to immunotherapy, because we can sort of educate the immune system that the cancer is foreign. We have antibodies called cell death proteins, one, PD-1 antibodies that will bind on the immune cells this PD-1 receptor and dial the immune system just a little bit so the immune system will kill the cancer. It's really cool. And I get it that we made, what are we, Dave, maybe 35? Indications for pembrolizumab. We had to get the setting right. That is what this study did. And both this and the relacorilant were published on the same day in Lancet on April 10. Happens to be my birthday. I'll never forget that day. So April 10 in Lancet. They're actually back-to-back. I won't quiz you and ask you which one was first. But this is a randomized trial of taking the best opportunity weekly, this time cremophore. Cremophore is the solvent that makes paclitaxel soluble, as opposed to albumin, which makes nab-paclitaxel soluble. But taking cremophore paclitaxel with or without bevacizumab and adding pembrolizumab to it versus placebo. And weekly paclitaxel is the most active agent, and we gave bevacizumab as an option. And we did it. This is number three. Mirasol number one, folate receptor alpha, relacorilant number two. Actually, this was number two. So we got this approved. This shows that patients can live for 4 months longer. 4 months longer. Someone, Dave and I were just having dinner together. He says, someone was telling us that this was a modest improvement. Listen, 4 months is 4 months. It's not enough. And I already told you we're going to keep rolling. This is the highest response rate that we've ever seen in ovarian cancer. To the left, 53% response rate. And again, it's biomarker informed, this time PD-L1. So you got three biomarkers, folate receptor alpha, HER2, and PD-L1. PD-L1, unlike HER2, which is almost never positive, this is generally positive. Folate receptor is in the middle, so this is positive about 3/4 of the time. And it helps patients feel better. We're kind of running out of time, so I'm going to roll through these. And so we got approval February 10. And we've been studying immunotherapy and ovarian cancer, trust me, for a long time. We had to figure out the right scenario. And this is a regimen. So relacorilant actually is not an approval for relacorilant. It's a regimen approval. Very different. This is a regimen approval. of weekly paclitaxel with or without bevacizumab. So this is something that is as we get smarter. So here, going to conclude and catch up a little bit of time here. You know, my first patient was 56. This is 59. You're like, Monk, are all your patients 50 that get ovarian cancer? No, some of them are early 60s. I mean, it is at the prime of their life, and it's true that the usual age is in the early 60s. Some can be 70. I get it. Hopefully, you never get ovarian cancer. And also, we haven't said it, but to reiterate, tubal or fallopian tube cancer is ovarian cancer after all, or peritoneal cancer. He said, why are there fewer ovarian cancers? Because he said that when a woman gets surgical sterilization, they take the tubes out. And if you get your tubes removed rather than tied, so the woman doesn't get pregnant, you're not going to get ovarian cancer because most ovarian cancers are tubal. So she gets treated like we've talked about, bevacizumab. There was no PARP here because she didn't have the HRD positivity. Has the surges we've talked about, had the PALA1 just like the last case, and then ultimately here she gets platinum again. That's what we do. If platinum works, we continue to give it. And then ultimately here she is, and she's a good candidate for bevacizumab. The reason I say that, because relacorilant, you can't give bevacizumab. Why? Because they didn't study it. And in fact, you're required to have prior bevacizumab to get relacorilant. They'll catch up, and maybe they actually showed it. They're adding relacorilant to immunotherapy. So there's a lot of crosstalk, and we'll do anything, frankly, that's legal to help our patients with ovarian cancer. So here you go, Dave. I appreciate that. And again, before I turn over for our final conversation, I want to thank you for what you're doing. What you do matters. And I look at law enforcement in the military, teachers and nurses. That's why we have a wonderful society. So thank you for being the nursing community. Thank you. Thank you.
My mom's a nurse, so hopefully you guys say she raised me well. So thank you. Wonderful discussion, but we have some really tough choices now. So tell me, you have a platinum-resistant ovarian cancer patient, second, third line of therapy. Tell me how you're going through. Let's stick with she's not eligible for clinical trial because she was just diagnosed with breast cancer 6 months ago, making her ineligible for most clinical trials.
Right. So there are five factors that I sort of evaluate. I get it, a lot of focus is on the biomarker. We talked about it, HER2, PD-L1, and folate receptor alpha. But that's probably, frankly, a small component. The second is, are you eligible for weekly paclitaxel? Because if you're not, you're not going to get Pembro and weekly PAC or relacorilant and NAB-PAC. And why wouldn't the patient be eligible? Because what you said, she's had a lot of platinum, she has neuropathy. Yeah. Third, you know, we launched PARP inhibitors. Again, that was the second group of medications that we brought in 2014. They're oral, and the first indication was PROC. And if I know anything about PROC, patients don't have the most normal intestinal tract. They got ascites, they got partial bowel obstruction. So you got to be able to take oral therapy if you're going to get your relacorilant. I hope she can. Okay. Number three, so biomarker, weekly pack, relacorilant, Bev, because you can't use Bev. And then ultimately, the number of lines of therapy. I try to prescribe, as per the label, Rosella, relacorilant, 3 priors. Merv's 3 priors. Pembro's only 2 priors. So I realize that that's some nuances, but that's the way that I sort it out. So basically, biomarker, eligible for weekly paclitaxel, oral chemotherapy, eligible, bevacizumab, requiring, and ultimately number of lines of therapy. And if you do that, you can cover about 80% of the patients.
So, Katie, I always said, if you can't keep somebody on immune therapy, they're not going to have immune toxicities. But now we have a regimen where we're keeping people on immune therapy. So we have to kind of re-educate ourselves. Now, we have an endometrial cancer, so we've educated ourselves about immune therapy. But tell us a little bit about how that may differentiate, get into a little bit about the symptoms, and we'll go from there.
The other thing is, you talked to us, what she said is that when I stop MAG-paclitaxel, I stop relacorilant. They're together. Mm-hmm. You're going to teach us that actually you can stop the paclitaxel and keep the pembro with or without Bev going. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. So we've talked about the combination of pembrolizumab, weekly paclitaxel, plus or minus Bev. This just outlines the regimen. It can be fairly tough appointment-wise on the patients because the trial was day 1, day 8, day 15. You don't get that off week like we sometimes give with weekly paclitaxel. And so they're coming continuously, which it can be challenging. They're getting the immunotherapy once every 6 weeks, and they're getting the bevacizumab once every 2 weeks. The most common side effects in the Pembro and the weekly paclitaxel arm were typical things that we have. Some anemia, neuropathy, alopecia, fatigue, nausea, some GI side effects, some neutropenia. But the interesting, you know, part is you add in the immunotherapy, so you have another subset of side effects that otherwise probably wouldn't happen with those other agents, and that can be things like hypothyroidism or hyperthyroidism. I tend to see hypo more often. You can have some adrenal insufficiency. Pneumonitis is rare, but again, you need to mention it. It could potentially happen. I love this slide. This image just is basically how I explain side effects from immunotherapy to my patients. I say, not everybody gets all the side effects. Some people don't get any of these things that I'm talking to you about. Most people get one or two, but the timeline of when they happen is certainly different from side effect to side effect. So you can see the skin rashes, the dermatologic toxicity, and the colitis can happen pretty early on. The bottom part is the duration of treatment in weeks. So about a month in, those things can start happening. Once you get between, you know, closer to that two-month mark, you can start to have some of the endocrinopathies. You can see that TSH start to change a little bit. Some of the labs look like they're trending towards hyperthyroidism, and then the pendulum swings back, and they actually settle in hypothyroid state, where you end up needing to replete and put them on thyroid medication. And then the pneumonitis can actually happen a little further into treatment. So those are just some things that I talk to patients about, saying if these things are happening, just because it didn't happen for the first couple of treatments that you received, it doesn't mean that this is unrelated to your treatment. So that's a really important teaching point. We've talked a lot about lab monitoring, and that's just as important with these agents. Sometimes we will utilize chest x-rays or CT scans if we're suspecting something is happening respiratory-wise. And then if patients have pre-existing autoimmune disorders, we certainly monitor them closely. And I like to reach out to their other managing physicians and just let them know what therapy they're on. And sometimes we end up co-managing together. But educating patients is certainly key. And the staff that's talking to the patients over the phone or the triage staff, knowing those things that you need to write down and let the provider know or send a message in the chart if you hear something that a patient says, that's really important and can help us act early and help manage these toxicities. This is our grading system. Grade 1 and 2 is more mild. 3 and 4 is certainly a more severe state. And with immunotherapy, oftentimes, if it's severe enough, we'll utilize steroid tapers and pause therapy. So that's how we manage that. This is an interesting slide. Is there a role for rechallenging after holding immunotherapy for some of these adverse events? And it really depends on the situation. It depends on how severe it was, what the grade was. We do know that those patients, if you hold for an IRAE, have a higher risk of having a subsequent adverse effect to the immunotherapy, but it doesn't mean that you have to stop immunotherapy for those patients. I have three patients on this slide that came to mind when I was creating this. So one was a patient on a clinical trial getting immunotherapy, developed a skin rash. We had to hold. We did some topical and then oral steroids. She ultimately recovered but had to come off trial due to how the trial was written and what we had to do as a result of that adverse effect. But we ended up getting her on standard of care immunotherapy, different agent, but works similar. And she's actually doing great, and she's going on 4 or 5 months in. So it's not impossible. I had another patient where she got hospitalized for increased LFTs. She had a big steroid taper. She was ultimately not able to be rechallenged. And then I had a patient come in on Monday. Her history was she developed colitis, was hospitalized, did a steroid taper, was back to her baseline. We restarted a couple of months later. The colitis happened with similar intensity, and so that's another patient where we're not going to be able to rechallenge. There are a lot of considerations, things like, has a patient had a prior transplant? Are they on immunosuppressants? Do they have autoimmune diseases, and how well are they controlled? I think, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all. You just have to take it patient by patient, case by case, and determine who's appropriate versus not.
So, Katie, Jacqueline, Brad, thank you. You guys did an amazing job. To our nursing colleagues, thank you for what you do every day, and thank you for being here this evening.